So maybe I'd like to get your full name and find out a little bit about your family history, if you're born in the city.
All right. My name is John Henry Batten. I was born in Liverpool, England. I came over here about 1918 or 19, and I lived in Winnipeg the rest of my life.
Can I ask how old you were when you came over? Did you come with family?
I was about 2 years old. I came over with my mother and father.
And they settled in Winnipeg?
Right.
And you went to school in Winnipeg?
Yes.
Did you work before you went into the army?
Yes, I worked in Eaton's for a while. I joined the army in about 1934 in the militia.
Now, was this Grenadiers?
In the Grenadiers. I was also in Cadet Corps before I joined the militia because I wasn't old enough. When I was old enough, I guess I was about 16, 17. And I joined the Winnipeg Grenadiers. I became an instructor of machine guns. That's a Vickers machine gun. As far as I'm concerned, it's the only machine gun. There's about 88 parts to that gun.
Could you tell me much about the training that you underwent and what other men underwent under you as an instructor?
I was sent to Royal Schools by my company commander to become an instructor. And after that, I instructed Vickers machine gun to trainees before the war and when war was declared.
Can I ask a little bit about what kind of instruction that would be?
It was given me by the PPCLI, Princess Patricia's Light Infantry.
Yeah. But, the instruction itself, just like how would you go about teaching someone to know about a machine gun?
Very difficult at times, because at one time I was given the charge of a Polish platoon. I don't speak Polish. They didn't speak too good English. And the only instruction I could do was by visible instruction. Now, I'd show them how to take the gun apart, put those parts into a gunny sack, take them out, put them back together in the gun, piece by piece. And then, eventually, I could blindfold them, and they could do the same thing.
You take the gun apart.
Right.
Put the parts in a gunny sack.
Right.
And then, you like dump it out, or take them out?
When you put it in a gunny sack, you don't know what you're picking up. You have to know by feel. You could put that part back in the gun, piece by piece, by knowing what you're picking up, what part goes where. And eventually, they would learn it. I can do it. I'm willing to bet you today I could do it in 5 minutes. At that time, I could do it within 2 to 2.5 minutes and have that gun firing.
That would be to put it back together again and have it
fire. Right.
Could you tell me much about the Vickers gun? Is it a good gun? A good machine gun?
Well,
do you have any faults with it? Or?
Sure, every gun has faults. The Vickers gun has 4 stoppages. And I'm not going to say that there's any gun today that's good or better or worse, because I'm willing to bet you that any gun today will have faults, and it will have stoppages, jams. A bullet will jam when you put it into the breech, and there's no way, I don't care, from 100 years from now it will still happen the same way. The Vickers gun was a heavy gun, but I'll take that against any other gun. It would fire approximately 500 rounds a minute.
I really don't know anything about a Vickers except I've seen a couple pictures of it.
You've never seen a Vickers gun?
Well, just a picture of it, that's all I've ever seen.
I'd like to have one as a souvenir.
It can fire about 500 rounds a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Is it air-cooled or water-cooled?
No, it's water-cooled. And if you ran out of water, you didn't run out of water, you'd find somebody that had to go to the urine, and you'd pour it into the tank and it'd go back to the gun, which wouldn't help matters too much. It would keep the gun moving, but it would keep going.
It should have water circulating.
Right.
How much it would weigh, the gun in the water, and would it take many men to carry it?
The gun itself, I say, would weigh around about 90 pounds. One man would carry the gun. One man would handle the tripod. You could have three men carrying ammunition. The ammunition was in boxes, belts, 500 rounds to a belt in each box, and they would feed it. One man would pass a box forward as you needed it, and your second gunner would feed the belt into the gun, and it was up to you to keep that gun going. If you got a stoppage, then you would clear the stoppage or whatever kind of a stoppage it was, and you had to keep it going. I would say five men to a gun.
The Grenadiers, I understand, were trained with machine gun regiments.
Right.
And they were very well trained.
Now that could be true, and it cannot be true. The men that were in the militia before the war were well trained. When we went to Jamaica, we had a lot of recruits that didn't know one end of a gun from another. And I'm not putting these men down, but we were training them on Vickers guns, right? When we got to Jamaica, they switched us over from Vickers guns to Brens. And I had to learn the Bren, because I didn't know a cotton making thing about a Bren gun. So I had to learn the Bren gun too. I'll still take a Vickers. But this is one of the things that happened. They changed their armament, and you had to learn it. So...
Was this new equipment that the Grenadiers were issued with?
Yes, after we got to Jamaica.
You were issued with Bren gun.
Right.
Instead of Vickers.
Right. And I guess the Bren gun was a lot lighter, a little heavier than a rifle. It would probably fire, well, I guess a clip on a Bren gun would fire 50 or 60 rounds, where your belt in the Vickers would fire 500. But you'd probably get the same firepower, because you have all your ammunition in pouches, and you just shove them back in the gun as fast as you can shove them. Whereas with the Vickers, it's a continuous fire.
Was there as much equipment sent to Jamaica as there was taken away? Did you take Vickers with you?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, we did.
But somewhere during the time you were staying in Jamaica, you switched over?
We switched over, yes.
Now, would everyone train on Wednesday in Jamaica?
Yes.
As well trained, do you think? Or?
Well, we didn't have the time. We were only in Jamaica for, say, 18 months. Okay. And I would say 6 months of that was on Bren, on Vickers, and the rest was on Bren. Well, you just don't go from nothing to a complete expert. And then when we left Jamaica, well, fine, we came back to Canada. Some of our boys were released because of sickness, and we picked up extra boys, and they didn't know nothing about a army life, and they had, some of them were only 3 and 4 days in the army when we left Canada, like left Winnipeg to go to Vancouver, and we had to train them on board ship.
When you came back to Winnipeg, did you know where you would be going after Winnipeg? Had you any idea?
I shouldn't say. Yes, I did.
Well, do you think the other men knew?
Maybe some of them did. I had a way of knowing through my father. He happened to be a good friend of the a certain person in my regiment, and he told him where I was going. My father told me.
How did you feel about that?
That didn't make any difference to me where they sent me. I had a job to do.
Can I ask which company you were in?
I was in C Company.
And what you asked for?
At that time, it was private.
You laughed.
Well, that's a story that better not be told. Like I said, I have officers that I like, and I have officers I don't like. Can I leave it at that?
Sure.
If you want to shut that thing off, I can tell you more. Put on then, we'll talk about it again.
Do you remember much about the train trip? Do you happen to know that you were going to Hong Kong?
Yes.
Do you remember much about the train trip going out there, about leaving people here in the city? Were you married at the time?
I was married at the time. Yes. I'm remarried.
Mm-hmm.
That has no concern of what you want.
No, I was just wondering, I wanted to know a little bit about, you know, what you went through while you were here in Winnipeg.
Yeah, I was only here for 30 days. We had a month's leave. Yes, my father told me where I was going. And we were told when we got to Vancouver, we had a little problem in Vancouver. Some of the boys wanted to leave ship, but they got them back on board again.
Were you involved with them?
No way, I didn't give a hoot. Yeah. I had a job to do, like I said, no. There was only 2 or 3 of them.
You mentioned that you took some training on the boat for when
you were training. We were training the boys that we picked up in Winnipeg after coming back from Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, when you've been in the army, say 24 hours or 48 hours or something like this, you have a lot of training to catch up on. Well, it took us 28 days in Hong Kong, which is not normal. I mean, normally it'd take a lot less, but with the zigzagging, which was the course they took, I think it took us around 28 days.
Do you know why they did that?
Well, how would you like to be caught with a submarine?
Oh, I see.
Not the Germans. Even with Germans or Japanese or what it was going to be. It was normal course for the ship to zigzag during war. But during those 28 days, we tried to train the boys that we picked up in Winnipeg because we were under-forced. In Jamaica, we were just a more or less a police force in Jamaica. We had a prison camp there of about, I guess, 1,200 prisoners. And some were Italian, some were German. And at the time, little did I think that I would be ending up behind the barbed wire instead of being on the outside of it. But anyway, we did our best to try and train these boys. Like we'd put tin cans overboard and have them fire at it with Vickers guns, and not Vickers guns, Bren guns and Thompson machine guns, rifles.
Thompson machine gun, is this a new gun for you?
No. I've known the Thompson machine gun ever since it pretty well came into being in the Army. I mean, it was in being before we got it in the United States. But no, I've known the Thompson machine gun for quite some time. And this was part of the stuff we had to do, was train these boys. And we tried to do our best. Some of them made it darn good. As a matter of fact, I would say 99% of the boys were very good in 28 days for what we could give them. They give their all, but the odd one was, well, you don't get a drop out and anything in the Army, in the school, or...
Right. So they were, at least everyone had a little bit of training.
Right, but not enough,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
Not enough. I mean, if you're going to send a man to war, he should have a couple of years' experience in the Army.
Yeah. Okay, you arrived in Hong Kong as a garrison boy.
Right.
Do you remember much about the arrival in Hong Kong? You've never been there before, have you?
No, I'll go back again just to look around. No, we arrived in Hong Kong. We're in issued tropical uniforms, shorts, shirts, pith helmets. We marched from the boat to our barracks at Sham Shui Po. It was actually two barracks, Sham Shui Po and Kowloon, Hankow, which were both in the city of Kowloon. And there we started training for war.
Tell me a bit about the training. Did you go and look around Kowloon and the island?
Well, we were more or less expecting it, yes, because we were told pretty well, I think it was 2 days before the ship landed, that we may have to get off the ship fighting. But as it happened, we got off the ship quite peacefully, marched to our barracks, and we started training. And then we were taken to points where we would be stationed. And we'd be trained there. Like, for a while I was at Aberdeen Island. And different spots around the Hong Kong Island.
Mm-hmm.
Was it setting up machine gun nests? Setting up machine gun
nests.
And we had bomb-proof shelters for personnel on telephones, for communications and things like this.
This is like headquarters.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we were taken out, well, I guess four or five times, actually, before the war started.
Can I ask about the equipment? Did you feel
there
was enough equipment, machine guns, ammunition, rations?
Well, our equipment, I would say, good 75% of it was on another ship that never arrived. Well, we had our machine guns. No, this is Bren. The Victors were taken away from us to Hong Kong. No, we had our Brens. We had our rifles. We had the ammunition. And naturally, when we got to Hong Kong, the British forces there and the Hindu forces, they had two Hindu regiments, the Rajputs, and the, oh my gosh, what was the name of the rest of the other one? Can't think.
Punjabs.
Naturally, they had their ammunition. It all fit the same guns. So we were fine for ammunition.
Did you get along with the Indians and the British troops? Did you get along
Well, you'll find the occasional brawl anywhere, but I would say I personally got along with them. I like the Indian troops. After being captured, I got along very well with a Portuguese. They were on a submarine that was captured. And I got friendly with them, and I got along very, very, very friendly with them. They even taught me their national anthem, which was just something to do at the time. You know, when you slack periods, when that's not making you work. But I got along. I didn't have any fights with any of the different nationalities.
Okay. How about the Chinese? Do you think they were glad to see you coming? Indifferent?
Or
they didn't want to see more British people?
No. I would say they were quite friendly. Some of our boys, just before the war broke out, like we were there, say, 3 weeks or whatever it was, before actually war broke out. And some of our boys used to go downtown once in a while and kick up a rumpus. Well, if you want to kick up a rumpus, they're going to kick up a rumpus. Let's face it, we had the same thing in Jamaica. So it's going to be tit for tat. You behave yourself, and they'll behave themselves. They'll treat you just as friendly as you'll treat them. I found that anywhere I go. But they've had some pretty good brawls. We've had some pretty good brawls in Jamaica, too. And I would say the Chinese were very friendly. After we were captured, I know for a fact that well, I was on the receiving end of quite a few buns thrown over a fence, electric fence. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to give us something.
Were these the people who had made friends with you
previously? No, just plain Chinese coolies, or we didn't know who they were.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as we were concerned, they were very friendly to us. They'd have to keep moving because of the Japanese seeing them. That was the end for them. But the odd one, like you'd find in any country, any nationality, they'd ask you for money. Well, all right, we had a little bit of money. You'd pass the money through the fence for some buns or whatever the heck you were going to get, soy sauce or some bean curd. When you pass the money, they'd take off and run, and you wouldn't get nothing. But I'm not saying anything against them. This happens everywhere.
I think in the 3 weeks that you were in Hong Kong, did you get fairly well organized with the battle? Or was organization just in the process? How about the leaders, the officers?
I would say we were getting organized. we were told where we have to be, and we could be there. Most of our officers were perfect, and they could tell you what to do, and you would do it.
Remember when the war broke out, how you knew that the war had broken out? The first time you knew, were you expecting it, by the way?
We were expecting it pretty well from the time we landed in Hong Kong. We didn't know when it would break out. It broke out on the 9th of December. I always thought it was the 10th because of the first bombing that we had. I was stationed at Aberdeen Island at the time, which was a Chinese graveyard, which happens to be my birthday, by the way. And they blew the living daylights out of every pillbox that the British had stationed around the island.
Yeah, and they hit outside perimeter.
Yes. They hit those first, then they tried to hit the anti-aircraft guns.
This was just in the first day?
The first day. That's all they had to do, because the British only had a few antique airplanes which never got off the ground. They blew them up before they got off the ground, so we had no air support. So we had anti-aircraft guns, our own machine gun fire, rifle fire.
Were you doing any firing at this time?
I was firing at anything that moved. Yes, I can remember going from the observation post up to one of the machine gun posts in a Jap plane. There was a valley, just a slight valley. And I can remember going up there in a Jap plane coming at us. I just lay on my back. I figured it was the best thing to do is just to lay down and lay on my back. And when he flew over, I started firing before he got to me, and I kept firing until he got past. Whether I hit him or not, I couldn't tell you. I'm not a hero.
Was this a machine gun?
It was the Thompson machine gun.
Did you have much ammunition?
Were
you stationed on the island?
No. No, we moved back and forth.
I wonder if you could just give me a little bit of detail about what actually happened during
the night. Well, all right. We were probably on the island. I may have been on the island. I couldn't tell you exactly. 10, 12 days. And I can remember taking my chum and I, taking a wounded man down. He got shrapnel on his back. We went down to Aberdeen, took him into a first aid post. And there was a school which the British Army commanded. And they had ammunition, food, and what have you. We went in there and picked up bunch of ammunition. I had a haversack. I filled the thing with 45 ammunition for the machine gun, which I got off a dead soldier, by the way, a dead Indian. I had a rifle before that. And I figured the machine gun was no good to him, so I took the machine gun and left them rifle beside him. But anyway, when I went down to Aberdeen with my chum, with this chap, the first aid post, we went into the school. It was a commercial school, I think it was, something. I knew the British had stores there, and we got some more ammunition. And they asked us where we were going. We told them we were going back up on the hill. And they said, well, it's, might as well take them up some rum rations. They give me a gallon jug of rum, we carried it up. Well, by the time we got to the top of the hill, it was dark. Then the boys were told to pull off the hill. And we uncorked the gallon of rum. And as the boys come past, we were pouring out to them, which we shouldn't have been doing. It should have been handed over to the officer in charge. But I never did see the officer in charge, so anyway, we got rid of the gallon of rum. And I had a good share of it. I didn't feel any pain. It would be a few days. It wasn't long. The whole cotton picking war didn't last too long. I think we lasted, what was it?
9 days.
Yeah.
Were you getting enough food and water at the time? You mentioned that you'd gone down to school to get ammunition.
Right, well, we went down to the school to get ammunition. Water? The Japanese cut the water off. Like it was piped in from the mainland. They cut the water supply off. We had a reservoir on Aberdeen Island, which they tried to blow up. And then they moved us off Aberdeen and took us back to the... when I say Aberdeen Island, to the mainland, and now I'm talking about Hong Kong Island. So we got back to Hong Kong Island. There was no water. We were drinking water out of ditches. And you didn't know what you were drinking. It was stagnant. But then you wondered why you'd drink anything. And that's where I was captured. I was captured on Hong Kong Island at Aberdeen. I'd gone back down to Aberdeen. I went down anyway, and that's where I was captured. They told us the war was over. They picked it.
Do you remember about how
long
you were functioned as a regiment?
During the war?
Yeah.
3 days.
And what happened? You just split up?
We were split up. We tried to be organized platoons or organized groups. I would say mostly disorganized. And we just wander around the mountains and do what we could. Clean up here and there. We were told to go, and 50 Japanese have landed on the island at a certain point. Take some men and go up there and try to clean it up. You get down there, instead of 50, there's 500 or something. But even though we were captured, I think we come up best. They lost a lot of men trying to come from the mainland to the island in sampans, because believe me, there was a lot of firepower going across that water.
Did you lose any close friends, or were you wounded?
I wasn't wounded until pretty well the last few days, and I got a piece of shrapnel. Still have it. A little scar right here. But at the time, I didn't even know I had it, because I was like everybody else. I was running. It hit me, and I kept running. And when I got to a place where I could stop running, well, I either sat down or knelt down or sat down or whatever I did, I don't know. Probably stood up, but I noticed there was blood running from my leg. And it actually just got the skin. It didn't cut a muscle or anything. So I went down to the first aid post and got bandaged up, and that was all there was to it. That's right. That's right. We were told to give up our arms and surrender, which what we did. And we had to go from Aberdeen up to our command post, which is halfway up a darn good-sized mountain. So we walked up there. And the commanding officer, company commander, had a big white flag. He said, we got to go down into Victoria to surrender. And that's what we did.
Did you have any idea what Japanese would do when you surrendered in prison? Did you have any preconceived ideas?
No. No. Not until we were halfway to Victoria, when they lined us up along the side of a mountain wall and set machine guns up. I guess we stood there for about 4 or 5 hours or more. And then the Japanese soldiers come along looking for watches, rings. Take them off the soldiers. I had one on. I had a hard time getting it off. And he grunted as much as said, well, you either get it off or I'll take the finger and take the ring off the other way. He got the ring. I kept my finger. Well, we were taken there to Victoria. And we were sent over to the mainland, Kalu. We were kept there for a while. We were shipped back to the island, kept in North Point for a while, and then shipped back to the mainland again. And we shipped back and forth like this 3 or 4 times, I guess. And then I shipped from North Point, which is on the island, back to Kowloon, and then they started weeding us out. I don't know how they chose it, whether it was the strongest, fittest, or what, but they'd think, you, step out, and then we were shipped to Japan from there. Shamshapo? When we first went to it, it was
the organization of it and how it functioned.
First, when we first got to Shamshapo, like getting off the boat?
No. This would be after the surrender.
Oh, well, there was not much left of it. There was doors, windows. Everything was missing. There was, I guess the Chinese took that because the Japanese hadn't got around to getting that far then. But anyway, everything pertaining to sheltering the buildings, the barracks themselves, was missing. We had to try and find stuff and barricaded up as much as we could to keep away from the weather. And from there we designated one building as the hospital designated one building as a cookhouse. And this is the way we operated, just trying to organize it ourselves.
Did the Japanese bring anyone in bulk food, or did so much food each day?
Oh, no, they'd bring us in bulk food, like bags and bags of rice. And I remember one day they brought in a truckload of pigs, live pigs, by the way. Well, the boys went at them and got them to the state of where they could be skinned out and cooked. But there's one thing they forgot, that they had to be hung, cured. They were cooked within 24 hours and we were eating them. Believe me, it was the worst thing that we could have done, but we didn't know. We had a darn good case of diarrhea right through the camp.
Would this be long after you were there, or short time? It's just like, if you got much meat or fish to eat before you were there, the vegetable.
No. When in Hong Kong, it was pretty well. The pigs, they brought in a horse, which we ate. And I think that was pretty well it, outside of vegetable greens, potato leaves, things like that. Which we had the same thing in Japan. But that's about it.
You were transferred from there to the North Pole?
Three or four times.
Did you work at that time?
In North Point, no. In Shamsipo, yes. We pretty well knocked down a mountain, knocked down two or three city blocks, and made them an airport that was second to none on Earth at that time, I imagine. And carry all the rubble and drop it into the sea. It wasn't easy work. It was hard.
Did you do a good job, or were you trying to sabotage
it? No way did we do a good job. No, sir. We walked as slow as possible, worked as slow as possible. Got balled out for it in Japanese, which we're beginning to learn pretty good. Got a couple of clubs across the side of the head. But, like you say, I'm not putting a Negro down. A Negro has one face. And that's the face you take. We did our best job when we got to Japan.
You know,
I couldn't tell you the date. I have no idea. No, I couldn't even tell you the month. I know I was in Hong Kong 18 months. No. You take it from there, and I was picked out with a group of 500, and that's okay. We were put on board a ship, if you want to call it that. We didn't know where we were going. We had no idea. We weren't told. And put on board the ship. We were on board the ship from Hong Kong to Japan. That was another 28-day journey. And I would say the ship was the size. Have you ever seen the SS Kenora? It was about that size. There's 500 of it on it, down in the hold. We weren't let up till night. At night, they let us up a few at a time to come on deck and get some fresh air. I think we had four or five die on that ship. And they were put down in the coal bins where they stayed until we got to an island to refuel. They refueled there and we kept on going. Bodies were taken off there. Then we got to Japan. We were taken by bus, train to our various camps. I ended up in Oyama.
Oyama.
Which is a nickel mine, a very small village. And that's where I ended up. And that's where I got out of when the war was over.
You were working in the nickel mine?
That's right. All Canadians, all some British, some Australians. They were mixed up bunch. We tried to do the best we could. Like we'd be working. It was a open pit mine. And you'd fill these little cars with the ore, ride them down the side of the mountain. Going fast enough that there was no way that a brake could stop it. Either flip them or take them right over the end of the rail.
They went down the side of the mountain to where there would be a port or a railroad? Or
yeah, they went down the smelters.
Oh, the smelters then?
But you'd be on that for a week, and then you'd be on the smelters for a week, shoveling coal to keep the smelters going. And then you'd be probably a week working in the smelters, like when the bricks and the smelters started to disintegrate, they'd cut that smelter off and you'd have to re-brick it. So you'd be going into the smelter itself and relining it with firebrick. But what we used to get a big bang out of was taking ore down, taking it to the smelter, into the crushers, get some huge boulders, put them in there and dump them. That poor old crusher couldn't take it too much. We used to stop production as much as we could. We used to get a few bumps for it, but there was no way they could figure out who had done it. You would take two or three men, but the whole crew did take the bumps. And then dysentery and one thing or another. You reported sick, and the Japanese doctor would come up and say, "What's the matter? You have dysentery." "Yes, I've been to the toilet 15 or 20 times." You'd belch across the head and say, "Well, you go to work or you don't eat." So we go to work.
Were the camp conditions at Oyama, were they worse than in the same?
Both
the same? Did
Reagan
have leadership in the camp?
Yes, there was leadership. in Hong Kong, they had a Japanese officer that was educated in Vancouver. For some reason or another, I guess he got a rough time when he went to school. Of course, I guess any nationality can get a rough time when they go to school. They call you a German or Italian or a Yid or you name it. And I guess they must give him a rough time, but when he was assigned to us, he gave us a rough time. I know three of the boys tried to go over the wire in Hong Kong to make it to the mainland. And somehow or another, they were waiting for them. And when they got to the mainland, they caught them and brought them back to camp, which was pretty well in the middle of the night. They brought out the whole bunch of us and lined us up in the square. That was it. They took their heads off. But no, in Hong Kong, in Japan, we used to do everything we could to do things against them. I know we had, I couldn't even remember how many Red Cross parcels that came in to Hong Kong, to Japan, to Oyama. We had to walk from prison camp to railway station, carry them, put them in a certain building. I don't know how many trips I made. It must have been tons. And we were given one parcel to every four men. And they were doing pretty good on their own, the Japanese. They were helping themselves. I know a couple of the boys got into this building one night, and they figured, well, they knew darn well they were going to get caught, and they just fed themselves up till they couldn't eat anymore, and I don't blame them. They were probably stealing from us too, but I don't blame them. But they were caught. And it was in the winter. And they were made to stand in the cesspool, naked, for the rest of the night and the rest of the day. And when they were let out, they died of exposure. But doesn't always happen their way. I know darn well when the war was over, the Americans found our camp, had planes flying over and told us to get the heck out of camp, get away from it. And they were dropping parachutes with food, medical supplies, clothing. And one chap, his legs weren't too good. He decided to stay in the hut. Best place for him to stay. And they dropped a parachute and a box of peaches dropped. Broke loose. Came right to the hut and took his legs off at the knees. Which, I think he's over that. We got him to the hospital. But there was one chap, I'll never know who he is, American pilot, He dropped a note on a wrench saying, open your cookhouse doors. They were sliding doors, you know, bamboo stuff. He's opened your cookhouse doors, and they opened it up, and they got out of there. He took another pass, and he dropped a bag of flour. You've never seen such a mess in your life. He hit those doors, and he just plowed that flour right all over the building inside. He couldn't have been more accurate if he'd have walked up and threw it. Well, he's damn good.
Tell me how you knew that the war was over. Did you know that the war was
going to be ending soon? Well, we had an idea. There was an awful lot of flashes going on in the sky from bombing, which we didn't know at the time what it was. Didn't learn until later. But yes, they came in one morning and said, the war is over. Your friends will be coming to get you, dropping you medical supplies, food supplies, clothing. And they brought in a live pig. I guess it was probably a peace offering. They only made one mistake. The guards left their guns in the guardhouse. War's over. We're friends. We're all friends now. That was the worst mistake they ever made, because in that camp there was one damn good fun deal going on. I remember one Japanese guard, he went up to a hut where some Americans were. It happened to be a two-tier hut. He went up the second floor and he said, we're friends, the war's over. That's the worst mistake he ever made. They just picked him up and he went straight out that bamboo wall and onto the Gallurn ground. But I hadn't regretted it.
Do you remember any other incidents that happened in the guards and then getting back to the colony?
There wasn't too many showed up. I remember one man going up to the commandant and demanding his sword. He brought it back as a souvenir. Matter of fact, I think he brought back two swords, the commandant and the interpreter. I didn't have the guts to do it, but for some reason or another, he did it. I don't know whether he's alive now or not. I met him in Deer Lodge.
Can I ask how you felt about the guards?
How I felt about the guards?
Yeah.
Well, I'd...
Pretty general.
I'd feel about the guards the same way as I'd feel about anybody that tried to beat me up. If I could get my own back, I'd do it. I would do everything I could to go against them, knowing that if I'm caught, I'm going to get a shellacking. But some of them, I will say definitely, were darn good. They'd even give you a cigarette. Others, no way. You couldn't get anything off them. We had one guard, well, when we were in Hong Kong, he had a great habit of rolling up a piece of paper and throwing it on the ground. And when somebody come along, he'd go, much to say, pick it up. When you bend down to pick it up, you'd get a belt in the rear end with his foot. And he thought this is great fun. And so one day he picked on the wrong man. He got a belt in the rear end, pushed on his face, except the guy got up and just turned around and belted him right in the gallbladder mouth. And he was surprised, so darn surprised, that he never even shot him.
Do
which I thought he would do. But this is the way it works. You get the good and bad. I think the guards that were nicest to us were the men that were in battle soldiers. The Japanese, they were like a home guard, like we had our own home guard. Like the men in Japan that were supposed to be probably what I would call a home guard, I don't know what the heck they call them. I think they were trying to be showing how tough they were. But the real soldiers that were in battle, they knew. And they didn't bother us too much. The odd time, yes. If we did something wrong, we'd know about it. But outside of that, no, we didn't have too much bother.
You had food brought to you by the mail.
Right.
Was it long after that before you were looking at it?
I would say they dropped food to us for approximately a week, and there's probably still food and clothing there. They dropped enough of it to keep Japan supplied for about 10 years. But no, we walked. They opened the gates and told us we were free, and then we walked to the railway station, which is about a mile, 2 miles away. Can't tell you exactly how far. And the first train in, we just took it. It was headed for Tokyo, and we got on it, and away we went. We darn near suffocated going through the tunnel from one island to another. There's a tunnel, and there's no air conditioning in that tunnel. There might be now, but boy, believe me, we darn near suffocated going through that tunnel, which was, I guess I have no idea the length of the thing. I can only guess and say it was about 3 miles. But all the smoke from the engine was coming into the coaches. But once we got to Tokyo, the Americans took over, cleaned us up, deloused us, and what have you, and x-rayed us. Got us in the hospital, and then gradually we were assigned to airplanes and gradually brought home. Took the actually 34 hours flying time, but in months, it took me almost 3 months to get back to Winnipeg, because I would say leave Tokyo, go to another point for refueling. I'd be put in hospital there, kept there for maybe a week or two. Put on another plane, go to another point where they'd come down for refueling. I'm trying to think of the name of the Kwajalein, Guam. And eventually Honolulu. But every time we were touched down, we didn't refuel and take off. We were put in hospital and checked for a week or 2 weeks or something like this. And
this is by the Americans.
This is by the Americans.
We were treated
very well by them. They gave us money by the American Red Cross, which I don't know why, because we couldn't buy anything. They give us everything free when we're in Guam. When the chaps and I went out of the hospital, and see this. They had a Coca-Cola factory, actually a complete Coca-Cola factory. And we said, well, gee, can we have a Coke? You can have anything you want. So that between the two of us, we picked up a case of Coke. Well, you got to realize that by this time, I weighed 98 pounds. My chum probably around the same weight.
This is when you were liberated from capital.
Right. And between the two of us, we got that case of Cokes back to our hospital. Well, it just disappeared like you'd never believe. We told two other guys to go back if they wanted more. But this went on everywhere we landed. Red Cross gave you $5 or $10. What are you going to do with it? You couldn't spend it.
What happened when you got to Canada?
Then we bought everything. Yes, we did. Except for one item.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you contributed well to the Canadian government?
We landed in Honolulu. I had two or three broken ribs because the plane hit an air pocket, and I just finished my supper. I went down to the end of the plane to the men's room. My chum was with me. Chum on the plane. Not always the same chum. Everybody's my chum. But we went down to the men's room. We were starting back down the aisle. The plane hit an air pocket. Downdraft. We hit the ceiling. We stayed on that ceiling until the plane stopped dropping. Then we came down. He broke his collarbone. I broke my ribs because we landed across seats. This is when we got into Honolulu. They took us off on stretchers. They wouldn't even let us walk. We went to Naval Hospital at IE Heights. Believe me, if you want to go to a hospital, go to that one. They treat you beautiful. From there, we went to San Francisco. From San Francisco to Vancouver. Where the Red Cross gave his money.
In Vancouver?
Yep. And Vancouver Island. We were transferred from one place to the other, back and forth again. This is the way the government works.
The army when you got back?
You were still in the army, you weren't discharged? No, I wasn't discharged. Given a new uniform. We weren't given a rifle or any packs to carry, that's for sure, because there's no way could we do it.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder if you got the same
treatment. No. When we got to Vancouver, Red Cross asked us if we wanted money, and some of the boys said yes, some of the boys said no. You had to sign a note saying that it would be taken off your back pay when you return home. The Americans never had anything like that signed. I'm not saying anything against the Red Cross, maybe that's the way they work. But that's the way it was. I owed them $5 and I paid them $5.
Have you noticed any changes in people's attitudes from the time before you went back for Hong Kong and after you stayed in prison until the time after the war?
You mean towards the Japanese?
No, and other people's attitudes. I guess people here in Canada, do you feel that their attitudes? Because As I understand, the Grenadiers left him his grave and all sorts of things, but when he came back in 1, 2, 3, 4 small groups.
Well, that's the only way it could be, because some of us come back by plane, some of us come back by ship.
Well, not only was they not saved, but I was just wondering if you know if the people's attitudes have changed much.
Well, I imagine people have pretty well forgotten it. I forget it. It's something in the past, like I said. I don't know about the civilian attitude. I didn't give a damn about the civilian attitude. What they thought was no concern of mine. My concern was myself and my comrades. And it still is. But... well, maybe I shouldn't say that because I don't belong to the Hong Kong Association. I have never joined. And, I would say my own attitude. I was bitter when I first came back. I can remember myself and Arnold walking down Ellis. And we knew there was a Japanese living in a certain house. And we picked up a couple of rocks that we found and we let him go right through the window, which I guess was absolutely stupidity. But that only lasts for so long. I mean, you get to the point and you realize that you had a job to do. They had the same job to do. You're fighting a war. You're getting paid by the government to do a job. They're getting paid by their government to do a job. Now, why take it on the Japanese in Canada? They probably didn't have anything to do with the darn thing at all. And eventually, I guess it took me maybe a month or 2 months to realize this. And no, I don't have no bad feelings towards them at all. As a matter of fact, a company I worked for a while ago, they had a Japanese carpenter come in and do a lot of work. And he'd yak away there, and the odd word I could pick up, and I'd yak back to him. With what I could remember, he looked at me. You understand Japanese? This is not too darn much. And we had a heck of a good confab, and we're still friends. And they're darn good people. I like them. When you begin to realize, we're both doing the same job. Whether it was Japanese and Canadians, or whether it was Canadians and Germans, or you figure it, you're getting paid to do a job. But what I'm gonna figure out is what they pay you. $1.50 a day to risk your life. I'm getting paid more than that right now, and I'm not doing that much. I don't have to risk my life. I might be doing more work, but there's no risk involved. And I don't know.
Is that how much you were getting paid? $1.50 a day?
$1.50 a day. Would you take $1.50 a day and go out and risk your life?
No.
You look at a guy and he's going to get a rifle or a machine gun or whatever the heck he's got, doesn't matter, a revolver. And he's pointing at you, and you figure, well, it's either going to be you or him. Would you risk your life? I did. But I won't blame, I don't blame, let me put it this way, I don't blame these people from America coming to Canada, and they say they're deserters or whatever the hell you want to call them. Is that the kind of money that... is worth risking your life for?
I remember after the war, I worked all the treatments that we received, studied on conventions and medical care and help. Was it enough? Do you feel it was enough?
I have no complaint. I have no complaint. I know this is one reason why I don't belong to the Hong Kong organization. I know that